Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I am Aaron.
And we're here today to talk about Season 3, Episode 1, titled Valor Dohaeris? Harris?
I think it's Harris.
Like, Harris sounds too much like a just a white dude's name.
Dohaeris? Now it's like saying giraffe five times. It doesn't sound like anything.
Dohaeris.
Hoaras?
Valor Hoaras. What does it mean? I know what it means.
It means all men must serve. It's the challenge response to Valor Morghulis. All men must die.
It's Barristan Selmy's new motto, I guess.
Interesting, because we don't see Arya in this.
No, we don't.
We don't see Arya. We don't get an update on Jaime and Brienne. That's the thing. Like, I remember when I saw this episode for the first time, I thought, we're going to see what Arya's been up to. But
you can't do everything in one episode. They do a lot. In this one.
They do.
And, you know, this is a season preview, so there's not a lot that's super exciting that happens, they're setting up a lot of interesting stuff here.
Right.
So what do you think of this episode?
It is a good season opener. It does a good job of introducing some new factions and characters we haven't seen before. We get a better look at the leadership structure of the Wildlings under Mance Rayder. We get introduced, I believe, we don't get introduced to Margaery, but we get to see how kind of she's going to function within the court and the setting up the rivalry between her and Cersei.
Yeah.
And
vying for the affection of her child.
And Tyrion scrambling to try to find a place for himself in this new world order. Mm-hmm. And frankly, for that matter, Davos and Stannis trying to find it the same way. And Dany, fresh after finding her dragons, now wonders, how do you take the next step? And what are the ethics of using a slave army to free a continent? Lots of interesting stuff. You're right. They do introduce a lot of stuff in an hour. What do you think, man?
Yeah, I agree. It was an enjoyable episode. This is a rewatch, so having seen this already, I know they're setting up a very enjoyable season.
Yeah.
With this beginner.
Also, something I think I neglected to mention on the season preview podcast is that we don't do spoilers. Mm-hmm. I realized that there was probably a lot of spoilers in the preview podcast because it was essentially the Game of Thrones stuff we did down in Texas, but in case you're wondering, we're going to cover the episode as if we haven't seen any other Game of Thrones episodes. And then after the podcast, well, during the podcast, but the very end of the podcast, we're going to do a spoiler section where we kind of do looks forward and see some material that might be interesting in light of other events. And then that's also where we can just kind of talk about Game of Thrones in general, because I know that's what a lot of fans like to do. You know, probably a lot of like what's going on in season 8 and stuff, but that's all going to be past the very end of the podcast.
Okay, cool. Well, let's get into the recap.
Before we get on the episode, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping because, my gosh, it's been a while since we kept house on Game of Thrones. If you only listened to our Game of Thrones coverage, you missed out on a lot. We did Mr. Robot, we killed The Walking Dead, we covered Westworld, The Expanse. Right now, we're covering Sharp Objects on HBO, also on HBO. We're doing that on the Bald Move TV feed. Since it's a mini-series, we didn't want to create our own feed. So if you go to baldmove.com and click on the podcast, there is a Bald Move TV. And we actually did a little bit of talk about the Time Warner AT&T merger and what that might mean for HBO. And then we also talked about Sharp Objects. We're going to be doing weekly coverage of that. We also have first-run Bald Movies. We have already covered a ton of great movies this year, including Annihilation, Ready Player One, A Quiet Place, Avengers Infinity War, Deadpool 2, Star Wars, Solo Star Wars Story. We're doing Skyscraper this week, the Dwayne The Rock Johnson vehicle. That should be a lot of cheesy fun. In the off-season, I'm writing a book with a religious scholar by the name of Anthony Ladon. We're doing a Kickstarter right now to raise money for editors, proofreaders, artists, so forth and so on. Book.baldmove.com if you want to get in on that. We've actually already hit our funding goal. We're looking at stretch goals right now. And I was super excited to be able to announce that we brought on the artist Chase Stone, who has done a lot of work for fantasy art for Magic the Gathering and did several illustrations for the World of Ice and Fire. He's going to be doing our cover art. I'm super excited about that. But if you're interested in the religions of Westeros and comparing them to the real life inspirations they gave, you know, just like the loose story of Game of Thrones is based kind of on the War of the Roses, a lot of the religions in Westeros are based on real life analogs in European and Asian religious cultures. And we draw parallels between that and use it to kind of get some insights of characters and maybe some future plot events. Check it out at book.baldmove.com.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We start with Sam running away from the White Walkers that attacked them. He finds his brother killed with his head in his hands, and a white approaches him to kill him, but he's saved by Ghost and Gior, who ask him if he sent the ravens. Of course, Sam did not, which causes Gior to decide to lead the men back to the wall to warn the rest of the Seven Kingdoms what's coming.
Yeah, the stakes are pretty high. We must reach the wall before winter, or everyone you've ever known will be dead.
Yeah. No, he doesn't mince words.
Dead as Sam's raven husbandry career.
Oh, man. I love the look on his face when he's forced to admit that he didn't send the ravens.
And Gior has the classic, "You had one job!" Uh-huh. You know? But pretty cool. Like, I like Ghost saving the day. What did you think about the fact that they yada yada through yet another battle? I mean, we had just feasted on the wonder that is Blackwater in the previous season, which is the first kind of large scale conflict that the show did, and they did very well. But I remember, in the first three seasons I did with another podcaster, Mad Brew, and he was an ex-military guy, and he was always frustrated with the shows, like, oh, we're getting set up for a big battle, and then. You know, the fade in from black and the battle sounds, and then it's over. Mm-hmm. Good budget saving. And also, yeah. I don't think George Martin likes writing big battles either, because he tends to do this in a text as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of before, there's a lot of aftermath, but actually, like, blow-by-blow, large-scale battles, not so much.
Okay, yeah, I had no problem with it.
Yeah.
Honestly, like,
I thought you, as a zombie guy, might want to see some, like...
I've seen some good zombie stuff, and no spoilers, you'll get better zombie stuff later.
Yeah.
So
well, this isn't the end of the White Walkers, what?
This is not, no.
Oh, okay.
I don't feel like I missed anything. I was actually very confused coming back into this, because it's been, oh my God.
Almost a year.
Over a year since we did season two.
I think, didn't it wrap up at the end of August?
We did it after and
it wrapped
season.
Up. Yeah. So it's been
almost
a while.
A year. Since season two, so I didn't remember anything about the end of season two.
Thank God HBO makes those season, like what do they call those? The catch-ups or the season two review? Or
I didn't watch that before I watched this, so my mistake, I guess. But yeah, I was very confused as to what was happening here and what Sam was running from. I figured it was probably White Walkers, given his location.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you are confused by this episode, I suggest going back and watching that season three primer from HBO. It helps a lot. So then John is led into the Wyland camp, where he sees a giant for the first time and nearly shits his pants, which Ygritte promptly teases him about. He's taken to Mance Raider's tent, where Tormund Giantsbane, who John mistakes for Mance himself, menaces him. Mance reveals himself and questions John about why he's there and why he wants to join them. And John gives first the wrong answer and then the real answer, which is he saw the White Walkers and the Lord Commander didn't care, so now he wants to fight for the side that will care, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting that John uses a large kernel of the truth to sell the overall larger lie that he's defected.
Right.
Because we know that he did really struggle with the... Not just the fact that the Lord Commander didn't care, but he already knew, and this was an official policy of non-interference with this man's infanticide.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, fucked up cult he's running from beyond the wall. So, I wonder. It's interesting to wonder, like, if Mance Raider, that's a decision that he made similarly too, because we don't have a lot of information on the show about why he fell from grace, why he left the Brotherhood, why he turned on his former brother Khorne the Half-Hand and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the fact that he thought this was a good answer, I think, maybe indicates that wasn't just freedom, wasn't just wanting to, you know, go beyond the wall and sow his wild oats.
No, but I mean, Mance here reveals in not so many words that he knows of the White Walkers, and it essentially buys John his life here, right? The answer that John gives is in line with what Mance already believes. You can tell.
Right.
And what Mance has seen himself. So, yeah, I think that's the saving grace for John, is that Mance is kind of in the same place as he is as regard the White Walkers.
Right. I think the way they portrayed the giants was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
It's utterly convincing. It looks great. It's very different from how they're depicted in the books. In the books, they're depicted as kind of like Sasquatch, like this giant, like they're covered in thick fur. They don't wear clothes. I thought this is a more interesting way to portray them.
They just look like a bigger version of Tormund.
They really do.
Honestly.
They really do.
Yeah. With a slightly weirder face.
Yeah, Tormund the Chicken Eater. That was his name before he got the Giant's Bane.
Yeah, it was. I do wonder if, when they were writing, what was going through their heads with this giant scene. Is it that Ygritte is latching on to the thing that they're both watching happen with the giant pounding the stake into the ground, and she's using that to say, hey, he can do that to you?
To pound the man in the ground, Jon Snow.
Right. Is that just Ygritte thinking on her feet here to tease John?
I don't know. I honestly, like, at this point, you don't know, like, what the deal with the giants are. They live amongst humanity. They're, like, in this very large army. Like, how effective are they in combat? She says they're shy but angry. Kind of sounds, reminds me a lot of, like, Chewbacca. He's a pretty gentle dude, but, like, you know, he might rip your arms off, especially if you've seen the new Solo movie.
You don't want to beat a giant Jess.
No.
I'll tell you, in Hollow Chess especially.
No. And I also like the little kids that are pelting Jon Snow with stones, because this is, I mean, these factions have been hating each other. This is like the Hatfield-McCoy feud times 1,000 years or more.
Yeah.
That they've been the boogeyman in each other's stories, and I thought it was a nice touch to have the kids kind of like, you know, increasingly the bravest one comes up and throws a stone, and they all start, and then Ygritte hands one of them their ass, and good times had by all.
And Ygritte, like, smacking that kid down shows you what the culture is like up here, right?
Yeah.
Like, kids aren't really treated as they aren't coddled, right?
No.
Like, they
can't
step out of line, and they have to be set straight.
Right, because if you step out of line, you might fall down a crevasse and never be seen again.
Exactly.
And freeze to death. But they do a really good job of showing the difference between Westerosi culture and wildling culture, because they have that. The fact that, you know, Jon is admonished for kneeling even before the so-called king, but beyond the wall, they don't do that kind of, like, weird obeisance to mankind like they do down south of the wall.
Yeah.
They use multiple ways to tell these stories, and I think it was pretty effective, an introduction to the culture.
Mm-hmm. All right, we go to Bronn. An equally effective scene here. He's with a woman in a brothel when Tyrion sends for him over what he calls a matter of life and death. Cersei visits Tyrion to find out what he wants to get out of the meeting that he set up with his father. She's very nervous about what Tyrion's going to say to him about her and Joffrey, given some of their actions during the Battle of Blackwater. Bronn shows up outside and insults the guards, and things are about to get violent when the door opens and the guards leave with Cersei. And then there's a shortish but very, very entertaining scene of Bronn squeezing Tyrion for double the pay to continue as his personal guard.
We covered a lot of ground in that recap.
We did, yeah.
I actually really, because the little moments in this episode, I think, make it. Like, the establishing shot of King's Landing, where there's these boys diving in the water to, like, loot the wrecks of the Blackwater.
Yeah.
Which sets up, you know, Davos's predicament here in a bit. I thought that was really cool. I like Bronn kind of, like, enjoying playing a little submissive role to the one of Littlefinger's girls. And I like Pod braving death. Because he's like, as Bronn tries to dismiss him, he's like, boy, I will murder you. And, you know, Pod, it's a matter of life and death. So he's willing to lay it down.
Now, some of Bronn's scenes, especially when he's with Tyrion, are the best scenes.
Yeah.
Just the rapport that they have and the casual attitude that Bronn has about everything, even when he's, you know, squeezing a lord for more money, more riches, more titles. Things like that.
You know, last season we talk about it being kind of a high watermark for Tyrion's personal power, and they do such a good job of showing how small his world's become. He's like locked in this tiny cell. When he addresses his sister, she's flanked by these larger-than-life Kingsguard, and his face is behind that little, you know, like portcullis thing in the door, and I thought that did a good job framing him. He's kind of scarred. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, they show, you know, how marginalized he is. And you mentioned, you know, him sliding that little window open.
Right.
It's funny to see Joffrey do the same thing
when
he's in the city. It's almost like Tywin's back, the daddy's home, and everybody has to kneel before him.
And you can hear his big footsteps stomping around the house.
Right.
So you got to stay on your feet.
No, it's good. But Tyrion, he's completely marginalized at this point.
And it's funny because, it's like, Cersei has ostensibly the upper hand here, but she really fears Tyrion's low cunning, as her father says, because, you know, she can't even beat him verbally.
Yeah.
And you can tell that bothers her. And also that it's not just all the shit that Cersei and Joffrey have pulled in season two, but, like, I think the lie that she's trying to fish around here is the whole incest question. What's this thing with Jaime and Cersei, and what's this mean about my grandsons? Like, what I think she's nervous about being on the same page about that. Mm-hmm. But that the line about you're not half as clever as you think you are, but it still makes me more clever than you, yeah. is a pretty sick burn. And the way they shot this too, like how they paced, they're like these caged lions. Since they're Lannisters, mm-hmm. like every time Cersei would cross the room, like Tyrion would pivot and orbit the exact opposite way. Yeah. I felt like that she was kind of like he's just so scared that she's going to pull. I mean, he's helpless. He's helpless.
He is. Yeah.
Like those,
and she had just tried to kill him, right?
I mean, that's with the Kingsguard.
Yeah.
Now he's got two and no bodyguards.
Right. So, but she makes a good point. You know, if she wanted him dead, she just. Have it done. Yeah. Although I think it's a little more difficult now that Daddy's home. You know, I don't think even as much as Tywin hates Tyrion, I don't see him as allowing
yes.
his children to kill each other.
Yes,
at least as blatantly open about it as would be like strolling into his chamber and murdering him with Kingsguard.
Like even Cersei, at her most cunning,
yeah.
would probably commit something that Tywin would see through as an amateur hour operation.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Like,
but I feel like he might be okay with it if it had some veil of...
Maybe.
Like, oh, plausible deniability
right,
here.
Right.
But to walk in and just murder him?
Right.
That's no good.
I think I also think that, like, it's one thing to be murdered on a battlefield, but yeah. I think Tywin just, like... If Tyrion got murdered within King's Landing, period, that would kind of impugn Lannister power. Like a Lannister got murdered
Absolutely.
In the seat of her power. What the fuck? I don't think she could get away with it, regardless.
No, I think the vicious slander that she's talking about here is partially that she had tried to have him killed at the Battle of the Blackwater. I don't think he wants. Or she wants Tyrion spreading that to her father.
There's lots of things it could be. It could be a Stannis letter with the true allegations of the incest. It could be mm-hmm. the plot to have Tyrion murdered. It could also be the fact that Joffrey turned tail and ran. Like,
yeah.
he was abandoning the city to its fate. And the fact that Cersei was holed up ready to die. Like, none of them covered themselves in glory except Tyrion.
Except
and Tyrion's
Tyrion.
One... getting shit on.
Yeah. No, it
so,
sucks.
Who's your money on, Bronn or the two King's Guardians? One of them was Sir Meryn Trant, the other, or Sir Perrin Mant.
Right.
Bronn was like, fucking with him.
He knew what he was doing there, yeah. He knows the guy's name.
I think Sir Meryn pulls a sword and he's got a dagger stuck through his armpit into his heart before he gets it clear.
I agree with that. I do worry about that second King's Guard, though.
He doesn't even have a name.
That's true. That's true.
He's like, it's like the Austin Powers. It's like, look at you. You don't even, you're just a henchman. You don't even have a name.
Yeah. He would have ran. He would have ran away.
Maybe Pod. I mean, shit, if Pod can kill. And that's the other thing, is I think you're supposed to understand that the Kingsguard is starting to degrade.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're well away from the days of Ser Barriss and Selmy's trying to maintain honor in the face of the usurper and all that stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, these guys, not only are they not honorable, but they're not particularly skilled either.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the other things you're supposed to understand about the universe. And even Bronn says, like, you're just a grub in fancy armor, better at beating girls than facing men in battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bronn beat them both pretty handily.
All right, we move to Davos, who wakes up on the rocks somewhere outside of King's Landing. I'm not really sure exactly where they are.
It's
because
like the mouth of the Blackwater, I think. Like the
yeah.
He's like kind of got swept out to sea.
Okay. Well, he flags down a passing ship.
Yep.
They ask which king he served, and Davos answers true, and it's apparently the right answer.
Yeah.
Stannis Baratheon.
I think it's kind of funny how he tried to maybe get away with, like, the one true king of Westeros, of course, but the guys weren't giving him nothing. So.
Yeah, and then, you know, he sticks to his principles here,
yeah.
and he could have died for it, because it's much safer, given where he is, to say Joffrey, you know? But he sticks to Stannis.
I also enjoyed the attention to detail that when he was waving him down, you could visibly see that he was missing the fingers
mm-hmm.
on the...
He got his gloves blown off
yeah.
in that battle.
Yeah.
Just completely torn off.
Yeah. I mean, he did get blown off his ship by that wildfire.
Yeah, he did.
But no, I thought that was a cool attention to detail.
I've heard shoes getting blown off. But
right, and then you're dead.
Gloves?
You're just dead if that happens. If you get your... there must be a subsection of lethality where if your gloves and shoes get burnt, blown off, it cancels each other out.
Right. Equal and opposite reaction.
Exactly. It's just science.
Holds your insides in. All right. Salvador San takes him aboard and tells him that Stannis is alive and he's in Dragonstone, but he's consulting only with the Red Woman, which Davos is not happy to hear.
Mm-mm.
So he begs Salvador to take him there so he can kill the Red Woman.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, this is another efficient storytelling. Like, they sell, like, honestly, they sell these people, these guys being long-term friends better than, like, Lucas ever sold Obi-Wan and Anakin. Like, in just this five-minute scene, you find out that, you know, like Davos says, you drank with me on my wedding day. And he goes, yeah, and you drank with me on all four of mine.
Yep.
and then at the end where he's trying to speak, because he's, I think he genuinely likes Davos and admires him. And he's like, look, your king has gone borderline Phantom of the Opera crazy in Dragonstone. He's burning men alive, anyone that says a word against him. And you're gonna cut this woman's heart out? Like, even if you succeed, you're going to die. And as he says, it's like, look, when you die, I'm going to gather your bones in a sack and let your widow wear them around her neck.
Which I guess I didn't realize that Davos was married.
He is married. We have some feedback about it.
Huh.
So.
Okay. He's just kind of been out.
He's been out.
Like he said, honey, I'm going to the drugstore.
That's right.
And 5 years ago, and now he's still not back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. We move on to Rob and Roose showing up at a castle which is unoccupied. I thought this was Harrenhal.
It is. It for sure
but
definitely is.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
What's your confusion? Because like the Lannisters essentially abandoned it last year in favor of going to King's Landing.
Right.
And they thought that maybe the Mountain would be garrisoning here too, but like apparently the Lannisters are just running from Rob. It's frustrating him in the establishing shot of this that, you know, haven't had a stand-up fight with the Lannisters in some time.
No, they talk about Jaime. My guess is that they think Jaime is leading an army somewhere. It's hard to tell based on the dialogue.
Jaime,
I know where Jaime is, but where do they think he is?
They think he's just, you know, running in the open country with probably Brienne trying to get back to King's Landing.
Okay.
That's why they arrest his mother. Well, they don't arrest. I mean, they already arrested her mother and they're sending her to a cell and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So there's the gruesome remnants of a battle here, including one surviving maester named Qyburn.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Rob orders his mother held in a cell.
Yeah, there's stuff that you can see that there's, like, you know, the Karstark, Rickard Karstark is continuing to be very salty about letting his son's murderer go free.
Yeah.
And
Rob sees that.
You know,
he sees it in the faces of the men and decides, I can't let my mother just run around.
Right. And even, like, as she kind of tells her personal cost, like, she sees one of her father's bannermen that died for Rob, that were all brutally massacred here at the at Harrenhal, and yet that's the moment he hardens his heart and says, find a chamber, it'll serve as a cell. And even his wife, Talisa, tries to intervene, and he's not having it. Like, he can't, I think that's true, like, he literally can't afford to be weak at this moment. Like, any more... He's got zero margin for political mistakes at this point because he fucks up any more time, his bannermen are going to start abandoning him, and all he's got going for him is he's never been defeated in battle.
Yeah.
And his direwolf. And if he loses his mojo, it's going to go bad for him.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to Tyrion meeting with his father. He says that he wants some credit for his role in the defense of King's Landing, as well as... you know, his rightful lands, which include Casterly Rock and his titles, and Tywin promises him other lands and positions but refuses Casterly Rock because essentially he hates him and everything that he represents. There's a lot of resentment there for a lot of different reasons. And then he sends him away, but not before promising to hang the next whore that he catches in his bed.
Mm-hmm.
This, for me, is one of the most memorable scenes of the entire series. Just because of how shitty Tywin is.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah.
It's brutal.
This defines Tywin for me.
Yeah. And, like, the anger that he feels at Tyrion, I think that he would dislike Tyrion just in general because, like, he... he's in a, you know, in Tywin's eyes, he's imperfect. He, you know, the Lannisters project this image of beauty and power and wealth and, you know, perfection. Mm-hmm. Like the vicious gossip about Tywin is he shits gold. Like, and then you got this like this dwarf son. I mean, this is how Tywin sees it. That's this person that, you know, against the golden god Jaime is just such a. Just doesn't measure up in multiple categories. Mm-hmm. And he's asking for, you know, what is his legal right? Because Jaime and the kings are, he can't inherit titles. He can't take lands. So who, the question is like, who the hell is Tywin going to give this to eventually?
Yeah.
Like, is he just going to give it like the skip a generation, give it to Tywin? Is he going to like give it to his brother's kid, Lancel, that little shit? But he's just so angry on top of all that stuff that, like, Tyrion also, he's being blamed for killing his mother.
Right.
Which is fucked up, but, you know.
Yeah, but Tywin is fucked up in that
yeah,
way.
Yeah. And then he also says that since I cannot prove that you're not mine, the gods have cursed me to watch you waddle about in my colors and banner. Mm-hmm. But I'll be consumed by maggots before I make you an heir to the rock. And yeah, it's really brutal. It's really brutal. And also, there was low key danger with like Shay and Tyrion because, like, you know, Cersei might find out, and then what would happen? But he was still the hand of the king. Now that Tywin's here, mm-hmm. like there is an exclamation point to this danger.
Yeah.
And last season told the story of Shay not really suffering well under this yoke of like, oh, we got to keep everything secret and we got to sneak around, and mm-hmm. now it's going to be even more dangerous, or it's like bad signs for their relationship.
Yeah, for sure. I have to say, I really love the Chamber of the Hand mm-hmm. As a set.
Yeah,
I think like there's no show that does sets better than Game of Thrones.
Right.
I literally can't think of a single one.
Yeah.
Most of the time they use real locations, which helps a lot. But then just the dressing is so good. Everything about it. It yeah. just feels like you're in the place
it really
at
does.
The time. Then we move on to Sansa and Shay sitting on a dock making up stories about the ships as they sail by. Littlefinger approaches Sansa to offer her a way back to her mother and sister. And Roz assesses Shay as, let's say, her kind of woman uh-huh. and warns her to watch out for Sansa with Littlefinger. Because, yeah. you know, Littlefinger is a manipulating bastard.
mm-hmm. Roz is a sad character because I really like her. I don't know that the show knows what to do with her because she is current, like, she knew everything there was to know about Littlefinger seasons ago, but she's impotent to do anything about it. Yeah. Like, she's stuck serving this just vile, terrible man. And all she can do is warn Shay about it in not so many words that he is this vile, terrible person that can't be trusted, especially around Sansa.
Yeah, and I think it's important, you know, that Roz grew up or came up around Sansa, right, in Winterfell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she has some loyalty even above and beyond what she does to Littlefinger, her employer.
Right. I thought it was a good touch that, like, you know, I grew up in the shadow of Winterfell, and when this girl was born, the bells rang from sunup to sunset.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice touch that she actually remembers that. And, you know, everyone loves the Starks up north, so I'm sure there's, like, actual affection here.
Yeah.
It would be terrible if she got ground up in the same machine. On the other hand, I'm not digging how snotty Sansa is. I feel like she's very quick to be a shit to Shay.
Huh. Okay. I guess I just read it as a young girl who wants to play a game and isn't being helped.
It's just
in that regard.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But on the other hand, you know, she's had to learn some tough lessons. Or maybe this is another attempt to just play a girlish game, because last season she was forced to be the backbone of the ladies of King's Landing as they're waiting to be, you know, murdered and raped to death by the invaders. But I don't know. It's like I keep waiting for Sansa to, like, become more than what she is. And it's hard to compare her to Arya. Because, like, Arya is so likable, and she's, like, grabbing things by the scruff and trying to, maybe no more effectually than Sansa, but at least she's trying.
Yeah, Arya is making her own way, whereas Sansa is just being led around.
Right.
And this is yet another scene of that. You
right.
know, I mean, I'm not sure that I can put my finger exactly on Littlefinger's motivations here, but he's clearly, Littlefinger always has an ulterior motive.
Right.
Getting Sansa out is not simply because he likes Sansa and wants to see her live.
Yeah.
And even something else behind it.
Like, I do believe he liked and even loved Catelyn, but he's not above murdering her husband and putting her in a situation where she's in danger.
Right.
You know, because Littlefinger, I think the most important thing to Littlefinger is Littlefinger.
Yeah.
So, you know, he might like you, he might be using you for a scheme, but he's everything's very transactional with him, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
All right, Dany laments her lack of an army while she and Jorah sail to Astapor. And we're kind of treated to a little dragon scene here, fishing and just flying around, tossing fish in the air and burning them.
Instant torching.
Yeah.
Seared ahi tuna.
Dragons like their fish cooked.
Yeah, they do.
They're not fans of raw fish.
No sushi.
For some reason.
No sushi for Drogon.
The Dothraki aren't taken to the water very well.
No, they're
but
not.
They are still here, which Dany takes as a sign that they'll follow her anywhere. And Jorah cautions her that she hasn't quite proved herself to all Dothraki yet.
Right. Especially the one on his hands and knees puking up three breakfasts worth of stuff. Like, that guy is not having a good time.
Yeah, he just had a grand slam from Wendy's or from Denny's, and he did not keep it down.
And they also mentioned that, like, the big one of the big tensions for Dany this season is how do you liberate a land or take something back with, like, good intentions if you use, like, slave labor. Because, you know, they're going here to purchase the Unsullied, which is the greatest parenthetical slave soldiers in the world. And what does that mean for Dany, who kind of grew up in a slavery chattel situation herself, who wasn't free to make her own decisions? How is that going to sit with her?
Yeah. No, it's a good thing for her to be wrestling with at this point. Because it's also made more interesting by the fact that she's very desperate. You know, she doesn't have a great avenue to find an army.
Right.
This is like the one thing that she thinks she can do here. If she wants to claim her rightful place. So she's kind of stuck between like a rock and an ethical dilemma.
Yeah.
Which is a cool place for her to be. Gives her something interesting to do, for sure, other than just looking for dragons.
Yes.
Damn dragons. All right, Davos arrives at Dragonstone, and he tries to convince Stannis to continue to fight and to ditch Melisandre. She claims that everything bad happened because Davos convinced Stannis to leave her behind at Blackwater.
Convenient, that.
Yeah, and Stannis tries to stab her, but Stannis' guards grab him and take him to the dungeon.
Yeah, I mean, she really provokes him. Essentially says all of your failures were your own and I could have saved them. And I wonder how much of this Stannis believes. I guess a lot.
I think a good chunk of it, yeah.
Because he's willing to throw Davos in the dungeon. And
there's a look. They specifically linger on Stannis when she says, you know, but I wasn't there because you convinced my king to leave me behind. And they show Stannis and he's like, yep.
Right. Because he believes, I mean, he believes in a large part of her power. I mean, she's demonstrated enough that it starts to make sense with him. But the final jab where she says, what I told your son was true, fire is the cleanest death. Almost like she prophesied it. It just makes Davos lose all of his cool, and he tries to make good on his threat to cut her heart out.
And those guards are in there.
They
quick.
Are. Yeah, and
they're on top of him.
It's interesting. There's like no hesitation. Like his buddy Salador San was talking, like maybe some of his men would be like not on board, but I guess the ones that aren't burnt probably are pretty thick in the religion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think seeing your comrades burn would probably change your mind pretty quick.
You wonder, like, in the campfires around, like, the remaining men that are still loyal to Stannis, like, how many people are saying, boy, if we had the Red Lady with us, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and it's really easy to, you know, talk about hindsight, right? Like, you know, what if? What if I was there?
Right.
Who knows what would have happened? All right, we go on to Joffrey and Margaery being transported through the city. Margaery stops to visit with the orphaned children. She tells them that their fathers are knights in spirit because they fought to save the city and promises they'll take care of them with food, homes, and clothing. And when they return to the castle, they have dinner with Cersei, who warns her that she could have been killed by the people of Flea Bottom. I think they're in Flea Bottom, yeah? Yeah, they mentioned Flea Bottom. Okay. Uh-huh. Margaery insists it's her duty to use their bountiful harvest to feed the starving citizens, but Cersei is unimpressed.
I think it's the contrast between Joffrey and Margaery and how deftly she's playing him is funny. Like, you start off when we're inside Joffrey's litter and he's got his little rag and he's holding it to his nose because, oh my God, these people are just garbage people and they stink and, oh, they're shitting in the streets. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And then Margaery just gets out and flounces with her dress through this big shit puddle and doesn't care. And she's effortlessly bonding with these children and she's telling the Septa to come directly to her. Like, she's being his human half. Like, you start to think, like, maybe this would actually work. This political alliance would work. Because, like, Joffrey is a complete garbage human being. But, you know, Marge is got a big enough heart for both of them.
Well, you need the Trinity. You need Margaery, Joffrey, and Tywin.
Yeah.
Because you got to have a military arm. And
sure.
I don't think that Margaery is up to that task. And I know that Joffrey is not.
Right.
So you got to get Tywin in there too to really have the full king in a 3-person package.
Yeah. And then the dinner scene I thought was great because once again, Cersei feels like she's being outmaneuvered by people that she's better than.
Yeah.
You know, like, she sees this as a weakness. And just the fact that, like, nobody likes Cersei.
No.
Her whole life, like, I guess as a little girl and as a young woman, she's just so extraordinarily beautiful that she could just get away with anything. Mm-hmm. And she's also from the richest, one of the most powerful families of Westeros. But now there's a couple of mentions about the fact that she's getting older and, you know, maybe all this, like, constantly sitting around and drinking wine has started to rob her a little bit of her looks and make her brittle. And, like, boy, if that goes, what has she got? And she's now seeing this very beautiful potential young new queen who also has a touch with the people, and that's a huge threat. And not only that, she's wrapping Joffrey around her little finger too.
Right, that's the thing. This scene is one of many that is all about the battle for Joffrey.
You know,
the battle for control of the kingdom via Joffrey, because Joffrey does not have control himself. He's being manipulated from all sides.
And since Joffrey put, like, Cersei back on her heels last season with, like, you know, you've touched me again or speak to me again and, you know, queen or no, it's going to go bad for her. Like, Joffrey clowns on her. It's like, oh, you know, my mother, her facts get less important to her as she gets older, and she has to just take it.
Yeah.
She can, at best, come back with, a lukewarm retort that's kind of aimed at Margaery, but
despite being entirely right, and Joffrey knowing she's entirely right, like, you know, he says, oh, our lives were never really in danger, but God damn it, in that scene, you were shitting your pants, kid.
Of course
kid.
He was. Of course he was.
And that's the thing
was.
I like about when Margaery stops, right? You know that Joffrey has had an experience just like this, and it went terribly wrong.
And that's the reason they're in these armored litters and under heavy guard, because of his bullshit last season.
And yet he's taking, you know, he's essentially ignoring the facts to dig his mother here.
Right. They also show, like, they've been telling this in a variety amount of ways, but we find out that, like, you know, Margaery's family from the Reach has been bailing King's Landing out. Like, they're the new Lannisters. They've got 100 wagons with food and coming in on the daily. There's a stream of stuff that they're gonna bail King's Landing out. And so even then, like, Cersei can't, even without Tywin, she can't be too rude, because what happens if Margaery's like, oh, you know what, fuck all this, I'm taking our 100 wagons, we're going.
Yeah.
Then the people starve and they destroy, they pull King's Landing down brick by brick.
Yeah, it's almost like Margaery is trying to turn the people against Cersei.
Yeah.
By both being kind to them and providing them with food.
Just by showing the contrast in the attitudes.
Yep.
Of the
Here's your old queen.
Yep.
And now here's your new queen.
You know the old queen. She's been around for a long time. What'd she do for you? Here's the new queen.
Yeah.
New hotness. And I also bake the bread and bring home the bacon, so.
You mentioned the 100 wagons that arrive daily.
Uh-huh.
I think it's hilarious because if you watch that scene closely, you can see that what Marjorie actually said when the scene was being filmed is 1,000 wagons daily. You can see her mouth say 1,000, but the dialogue says 100.
The rare time where the double D's actually took a step back and said, is this believable?
1,000? Really?
That's a lot of wagons, right?
That's like that's one order of magnitude too many.
Yeah. Not a spoiler, but they're not as good about that in later seasons. It's just like, 1,000 ships, 10,000 men, 100,000 men, 1,000,000 dragons, whatever, you know?
Right. Danny arrives at Astapor and is treated to a demonstration of the Unsullied Army's obedience and told about their rigorous training, while their owner insults her behind the veil of his interpreter. And Danny is displeased with the cruel methods of their training, which includes each one of them going out and killing a child, a small baby in front of their mother, and then paying a silver coin to the owner of the baby.
For the loss of the potential slave. No, I mean, this... Yeah, how does a society like this continue for any amount of... Like, I don't know. Maybe this is me being soft-hearted and headed, but, like, I gotta believe that a society that evil would just collapse under its own shittitude.
Yeah.
You know, like, that fucked up view of human life. Like, there's just no way that you can... There's just no way that that's a stable equilibrium.
You wouldn't think so.
But then again,
I can't imagine the vice grip you have to have on the people to make that work.
And you
got to
make these fanatical soldiers where only one out of four boys survived the train. I mean, this shit's like right out of Warhammer 40K, like training the Space Marines. And that is often seen as like self-parody and, you know, just up its own ass. But like, this is just a terrible, terrible, evil cancer on the planet. And like, you even see like the owner, the slave owner, can't even be civil to a client,
right?
Like, he's just he thinks he's better than everyone. It's he calls Danny an ignorant whore. I forget what he says to the knight, Sir Jorah, but it is high comedy though. The translator like says, tell this ignorant whore to watch this. But the master begs you to attend to this demonstration carefully.
Right.
And the dude just like cuts off his nipples, and you find out these guys are all castrated, and it's bad.
Yeah, I mean, they're really setting him up to be the worst.
He is.
And I don't know what they're going
to
do with that. But...
You know, it almost been an interesting idea to show these guys as like more of a velvet glove. Like, you know, Danny already had a moral conundrum just doing this transaction. Mm-hmm. Having these guys be just the height of scum and villainy kind of makes the decision easier, right?
It does make Jorah's argument resonate. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like that maybe, like, if these guys were a little bit, you know, more civilized and, like, cultured and... He tried to make some argument. I don't know. I don't know how they could put a good face on the brutal nature of this training, but and just the fact that you're turning men into automatons.
Yeah.
But they didn't even try.
Yeah, and I wonder if it, you know, his disdain for Danny stems from her being a woman wanting to buy his army.
Probably a good chunk of that.
Like, yep. I wonder if he would treat, you know, Jorah the same way if he were to come up and try and buy the slaves.
Right. I mean, I'm certain he wouldn't respect Jorah anymore, but there certainly is I have no problem ascribing sexism to this guy's many, many sins. Like, why not? Throw it in the fucking heap. Set it on fire.
Yeah.
I also like this, like, I mean, it gets the progressive revelation. Like, Danny arrives at Astapor, and we are informed that these guys have been standing here for a full day and night without food and water, and just like, and then you find out they're training, and he cuts off one of their nipples, and then when the guy, when he's like, yeah, I'm done with you, and the guy's like, it pleases me to have served you, it's like, it's Jesus, wow. Yeah.
It's brainwashing.
Yeah.
Of the highest order.
Yeah.
After the meeting, Danny discusses the ethics of owning a slave army with Jorah as they follow a girl who wants to play with him, and a man in cloak also follows them. When the girl throws her a ball with a scorpion creature in it, the cloaked man saves her and reveals himself as Sir Barristan Selmy, who says that he failed her family, whom he has sworn to protect, and pledges himself as her protector if she'll have him. Not a great argument, Sir Barristan.
Right.
You come up and you say, I failed the last person I pledged to protect in every way imaginable. I would love to be your protector if you had
Then
me.
I got fired from the other job I took.
Yeah. Much worse argument than the arguments Jorah is making for the slave army.
It does move Danny, though. The fact that this is the man who was the king's guard to... her father, I think, was interesting. The other thing that was interesting is that in the book, he wears this disguise for an extended period of time. And he goes around as Ariston Whitebeard. And it's like a big reveal when they find out that he's actually, Selmy. But in the show, George does this all the fucking time where people have thin disguises or different names. But you just can't do that in the show.
Right.
The guy is who he is. And it would be tedious for the if you get six episodes in and it's he steps forward and says I'm Barristan Selmy. So I think it was cool how they adapted this to where it didn't really matter. I also thought that I thought the sequence where the little evil girl warlock, how they did her up to where she had the blue teeth and you could just instantly tell that she's one of them, and she jumps into the water and then teleports, and the fucking creepy death's head scorpion. That shit was really cool.
I thought that the warlocks had been burned up in the House of the Undying.
But what does that even mean?
That's a good question. Yeah.
To a warlock.
Or maybe there are more. I thought those were the only that was the only warlock, the one that she burned. But
no, they're essentially running the same scam that's in the Prestige. They're just 100 of them, they all look the same. They're not even really teleporting. It's all stagecraft.
Yeah. And it doesn't even look like Dany is hearing the arguments that Jorah is making.
Right.
Because she's so enthralled by this little girl's playing. Jorah's saying all this stuff are you going to treat them better? Imagine their lives under you as opposed to this guy. And she's just smiling, looking into the distance at this girl.
Yeah, you can see how that would be effective. Someone's going to buy these slaves.
Sure, yeah.
Might as well be you, because you're going to be cutting off their nipples, right?
No, he almost frames it as saving them from the fate that they're currently living.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure why Jorah's reaction to Selmy coming forward reads as a jealous one. I could see it being a nervous reaction, but it reads to me,
he's the sworn protector of Danny.
it's another old ass dude moving in on my territory. It's hey, there's already one slightly too old for this queen guy jockeying for her position, and don't need another one. But I don't know. That's Jorah's weakness, is that he is insanely... He's in love with Danny in every way you can be in love with someone, and quite unrequited.
Yeah. But that's it. That's the end of the episode. That whole scorpion thing.
There was a dedication at the end of the episode, Martin Kinsey, and that this guy was a British second unit director and cinematographer who worked on The Shining, Return of the Jedi, Aliens.
Wow.
The King's Speech, and HBO shows Rome and, of course, Game of Thrones. And he tragically died at the age of 56 of a cancer shortly before the season. And there was I found a picture of him standing on the Wildling, wherever they filmed the Wildling shit in Norway or Finland or whatever. I thought that was a nice little tribute.
All right.
Shall we do feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
As we mentioned in the housekeeping part of the podcast, before we move on to feedback, we do a lot of stuff here at Bald Move. We do TVs, we do a lot of TV shows, a lot of your favorite TV shows, a lot of your favorite movies. Now we're doing an off-season in the middle of a Game of Thrones content drought. We're doing a rewatch of season 3. How do we do that? How do we pay the bills?
We're warlocks.
That's
and we just conjure gold
we
out
do.
Of nothing.
We do. We conjure. We are packed to the rafters with death head scorpions. We haven't figured out a way to convert that to gold yet.
No.
And me turning into a little girl with blue stained teeth just isn't the moneymaker that you'd think it would be. So we've fallen back on our club, club.baldmove.com. If you sign up for the club, not only do you have the satisfaction of knowing that you're allowing us to produce our independent content, but you also get a lot of bonus features. We do video versions of a lot of our podcast. Each week we do the fabulous variety show called Lunch with Jim and Aaron, where we talk about whatever, and we also take a live Q&A from our audience. We do spoiler versions of our first run Bald Movies, so you can get like detailed takes on the hottest movies out. Just tons of stuff. We got this thing called Quip, where we quit your pitching, where we pitch absurd TV shows to each other, and I've heard that that's funny. A lot of people like it. A lot of people enjoy it. And there's a ton of other stuff. You can go to club.baldmove.com and get samples of each one of these features. And if you sign up, you get a 30-day free trial. Go to club.baldmove.com and support Bald Move today. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
If you want to give us feedback, it's Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. You can give us spoiler feedback, non-spoiler feedback. I will sort it out and we will consider it on the show. It's typical that we get much more spoiler feedback, the non-spoiler feedback, because the majority of people of, you know, it's the biggest television, I don't know if you heard, biggest show on the planet, 100 million people watching. If you're a latecomer, that's cool. Glad to have you on board, but you're in the minority. But if you are, please send me that feedback. I'd love to consider it. Mm-hmm. First up, Tori W. from Texas. I hope this gets to you all before you record, and she wanted to know in the future, or he, I don't know, Tori could be a he or a she, in the future, when do you all record?
Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
Tuesdays,
Eastern
are we
time.
Gonna do? Are we going to make that standard?
I mean,
the only thing that might, because we got some travel coming up, like the summer, sometimes it changes, and...
Yeah, not Tuesdays, sorry, Thursdays. Tuesdays are our normal day.
Yeah.
In the on season. Off season, it's Thursday at 1 p.m.
Normally it's going to be Thursday at 1 p.m., but there are, like, we got to go to Philly for the podcast movement event, and it might
change.
Yeah,
we won't be doing a live recording then.
Yeah, some things. But, like, in general, like, if you get it to us the Sunday before the week, you know, obviously we'll be all good to go. Mm-hmm. On with the questions. When Cersei and Tyrion are talking, there's mention about a servant girl getting beaten or killed on Cersei's behest. Is this event explored more in the books? What happened or what became of this? I don't think so. There's certainly tales of Cersei being a shit as a girl that will be illuminated as we get further in the story. But I don't think so, because that scene between Cersei and Tyrion is an entirely like a show invention that never happens in the books. So I don't think so. They also say when Sir Davos Seaworth and his pirate friend are talking on the ship after rescue, his pirate friend makes mention of Sir Davos' wife. I don't believe we've ever met Mrs. Davos in the Game of Thrones show. Is she more of a character in the books? Will we meet her in the future?
She's just an onion.
She is.
She's just a human being shaped effigy made of onions.
It's just like Wilson from Castaway. Uh-huh. You know, Davos gets lonely and he carved a face on an onion. I'm going to start there.
Okay,
I'm going to stop
there. Good idea.
Onions have layers. She's mentioned a little bit more. Davos writes, like, so Davos being made a knight, he gets a small keep in the Stormlands on, I think it's called the Cape of Wrath. So he's got a little steadfast, and in the books, he's got a lot more kids. He actually brought 5 of them to the Battle of Blackwater, and all but one died. So he's like, you know, he's got his grief multiplied by 4, and his wife is at home with the 2 youngest children. He writes her and he thinks fondly of her, but like, no, she's not a big character in the books. So don't be looking for Mrs. Davos. Although, who knows? Season 8. That's her moment to shine. Finally, some more of a statement than a question. Did you notice that when Margaery comes out of the orphanage and is talking with the women running the orphanage about if they need anything to come directly to her, that she's literally standing where the shit puddle would be located based on the previous scene? maybe she's like an elf in Lord of the Rings. She just kind of like floats above it. Uh-huh. But yeah, she was standing ankle deep in raw human sewage.
And in prime bucketing position.
Yeah.
So like somebody upstairs takes another shit.
Right.
She's getting covered.
Yeah.
It does make me wonder what would cause a family to dump shit at the doorstep of the building they live in.
I guess that...
Like dump it to the left a little, you know?
I mean... I think that's a thing, though, that, like, people did in the Middle Ages. They just dumped shit and garbage in the street because they didn't know about germs.
Yeah, I mean...
Are you gonna walk 5 miles to the edge of the city to dump it? There was no, like, you know, the Romans' invention of indoor plumbing and aqueducts had been kind of lost to the ages.
I get it. Just a little to the left.
Yeah.
Or the right. Either one.
And also,
just
like...
not in the door.
I just think things stank back then, too.
Yeah.
Like, that's another thing. Like, the Romans had this kind of high standard of hygiene. They took regular baths and showers, but then, like, that kind of went away in the Middle Ages. People started, you know, thinking that, I don't know, like, baths are something that would kill you. And they stank accordingly. So maybe it just didn't, can you imagine being in, like, London, like, in circa 1100?
Yeah.
It's like... Just the people stank.
Paris or something.
The streets stank. everything just was god awful. I think it's like it probably is like living on a hog farm where eventually like you just don't even smell it.
No, I get upset when I go to like a city and a homeless person is pissed in a corner somewhere.
Sure.
And I get a slight whiff of it. What if that was just 24/7?
Yeah. Well, you'd get used to it.
And much, much worse.
You'd get used to it.
It's like living on a pig farm, you know? Eventually, you don't smell it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Audrey T., this isn't strictly a season 3 question, but I've always wondered why Jorah is called Jorah the Andal. If he's from the north, shouldn't he be one of the first men? Yeah, but if you pay attention, you'll find that he's only known as that by the Dothraki, and you're supposed to understand that they're just ignorant of how Westeros works.
Huh.
It's like, you know... from Indiana, like the way like Southerners call everyone Yankees, regardless of like how far north they are or whatever. Like mm-hmm. it's just kind of like the idea that there's the First Men and there's the Andals and there's all this, like that's just lost on the Dothraki. They're just all the Andals. Mm-hmm. So it's a mislabeling of him. But what's Jorah going to do? Correct every single Dothraki screamer right. that calls him the Andal.
Yeah.
Mian wrote me and said, I must know the correct way to pronounce Aaron Dampier. That's the gentleman that baptized Theon last season. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not implying you're wrong, because good old Roy, rest in peace, Roy Dotrice, who is the audiobook narrator of the entire Game of Thrones series thus far,
mm-hmm.
or a Song of Ice and Fire series, good old Roy has been playing fast and loose with some of the pronunciations, such as Brienne and Catelyn especially, and just curious. Well, I'm going to let the man himself weigh in here. I've got a link from George R. R. Martin where he himself clears this up.
How do you pronounce Aaron Greyjoy's title, Dampfer? That's from Rob.
Dampfer.
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 Okay,
yes.
Okay, Dampfer.
I suppose I should have put a hyphen in between to make
that's
it clear.
All right.
This is because he's all wet.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense.
So there you go. I do think that it's confusing because, as he said, he didn't hyphenate it. And there's like there's a fantasy term for vampire. That's like a half human, half vampire called mm-hmm. like a dampire that's spelled similarly like that. So like I think that maybe people just, I don't know. But to me, it just read like this guy has got damp hair. He's this saltwater priest and he's just always in the surf drowning people. So he's got damp hair. But that's how you pronounce it, Dampier. And that's all the non-spoiler feedback we got. If you'd like to send us some of any stripe, please send it to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. We also will have a thread each week. I'm only going to be creating a spoiler thread going forward because I think the non-spoiler thread doesn't get as much traction. But I'm going to be creating one for the spoiler thread. If you are a non-spoiler person and you want to create one, just do it, you know? Anyone can create a thread on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. Let's proceed to the spoilery territory. Before we talk about the feedback, did you have anything you want to talk about as far as just like things that made you go about the future?
Yeah, so first of all, just a minor observation. It's really funny seeing how they're playing Tormund when he's first introduced.
Yeah.
As this very intimidating warrior guy.
Mm-hmm.
Where in later seasons he has very much become comedy relief, comedic relief, you know.
Sure.
He doesn't do much that I would call badass or intimidating anymore. He's mm-hmm. more about like his googly eyes and his affection for Brienne, that kind of stuff. It was almost a little jarring to see how they play him in the beginning.
Right. And I also like that they call him the chicken eater because that kind of makes a connection to the Hound, because the Hound famously, you know, had to eat every chicken in this goddamn room.
Mm-hmm.
And in season 7, they have a bit of a bromance or what'd you call it? Like an anti-bromance, because it's essentially Tormund trying to get the Hound out of his shell a little bit.
Yeah.
To probably not much effect. But I thought that was, I mean, surely they didn't intend that. But it's a cool little, you know, hindsight being 2020 detail. The other thing, anything else or? Okay.
Rolling. Plenty of stuff. There were a couple of important characters introduced in this episode for the first time. Missandei is introduced and Qyburn's introduced.
Did they actually introduce Missandei as a named character? I don't think so.
He says her name at one point.
Does he really?
He does. When he goes to cut off the nipple of the guard, he says Missandei or something.
Okay.
But I don't think they make a point like that's her name.
Right.
He just says it, and I recognized it because I know it's her name.
Right.
Qyburn, obviously named, and he's going to be a thorn in most people's sides going forward.
The other thing I thought was interesting was when Cersei made a comment about Tyrion. She goes, oh, your wound isn't all that bad. I heard you lost your nose.
Yeah.
That's a reference to, in the books, Tyrion does get... I mean, Tyrion in the books is a lot less attractive than Peter Dinklage in real life. He's got a hunchback. He walks with this weird gait because one of his legs is shorter than the other. He's got mismatched pair of eyes. He's described as extremely ugly. None of these things apply to the Peter Dinklage, who is quite an attractive man. And then they just literally chop his nose off, so he's just got that gaping fucking hole in his face, making him look even more like a monster. So I thought that was an interesting kind of like nod and a wink to the book readers.
Yep.
I also thought the line from Roose Bolton where he goes, I've got my best hunters after Jaime. I don't think that's literally true because we find out later that surely Ramsay would be his best hunter. If he wanted to run a man down, he'd send Ramsay with his pack of dogs and that crazy woman that he's got. But he's off just fucking with Theon in the Dreadfort. Mm-hmm. So... is this an early indication, if you're in the know, that Roose is kind of working both sides?
Could be.
He's like sandbagging his liege lord's attempts to I don't know, achieve his political objective.
Yeah, could be.
I thought it was an interesting note. And then the other thing, I know that there's a theory out there that Tyrion is not actually Tywin's son, and he's actually well, there's a lot of theories, but the one that's not so crazy is that he is the illegitimate son of the Mad King, Aerys II, because there are a lot of hints, like Barristan Selmy talks about, like, the fact that Aerys took improprieties with Joanna Lannister on their wedding night. And there's also George Martin, when he released The World of Ice and Fire, specifically put in a timeline that brought Joanna Lannister back to King's Landing about 9 months before Tyrion was born. And there's an implication that he could be like this illegitimate, a secret Targaryen. Mm-hmm. And that drives a lot of people crazy for a variety of different reasons. They think that, like, it cheapens the enmity between Tyrion and Tywin, which I don't understand at all. Hmm. But I thought that this line from Charles Dance where he goes, you know, I can't prove that you are not mine. So in the show, at least, I think that I don't, what you could argue that maybe he's just saying that to piss Tyrion off. But the plain reading is that Tyrion privately doesn't think that he's his son.
Tywin doesn't, yeah.
Tywin.
No, that's interesting. I was not super aware of, like, the details of that. So makes a lot of sense.
But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting too. And that's all
is
the
that,
stuff
is
that
is
that
I, a season 8 reveal? Season 8, they're going to go for that in the 6 episodes they got left.
I don't know, because like there's a strong theory that like the three heads, the dragons must have three heads, mm-hmm. and that like there's this special affinity for the dragons to Targaryens, and we saw that in season 7 where one of the dragons was the Rhaegal. In fact, it's the one that's the namesake of Jon's actual father, kind of like showed affection to Jon instead of just roasting him when they first met. And then Tyrion also had a little bit of a dragon whisperer moment when he set the two remaining dragons free from Meereen.
Right.
When he went down into the crypts and, you know, unchained them and they didn't hurt him. There was a big, you know, a pretty big theory that, like, well, the secret Targaryen thing might be true, because then you'd have Jon, Dany, and Tyrion. Three. There's your top consensus top three fan favorites. They're essentially in everyone's top five. And how awesome that would be, but in season 7, there doesn't seem like they're going that direction.
And they took out one of the dragons, which to me says, we're not going to do this thing, even if that's what was intended. Now we just need two heads.
So is that still going to be a thing in the book? I mean, that's the messy thing about the books being taken over by the show, and how there might even be a little bit of bad blood between Martin and the Double Ds, which is unfortunate, but... you know, it's the hand that got dealt. So,
yeah, watching this scene with Tywin and Tyrion, where he's shitting all over Tyrion, I couldn't help but think how much different things turn out if Tywin gives Tyrion what he wants here.
Oh, if Tywin nurtured, Tyrion's natural ability?
Because, the key thing here being Tyrion wouldn't have killed him, right?
Right.
So Tywin would have still been around to manage the kingdoms.
Right.
And I think, none of this stuff with Margaery and Cersei gets out of hand. The High Septon doesn't step in and cause all sorts of problems. This kingdom might still be in the shape it needs to be in to combat whatever Dany can bring.
Yeah, imagine if Tywin had shored up his support with his son, and he's got Tyrion, and he could get Varys on his side, which I think Varys has got his own motivation, but who could take him out?
Dany might not even have been able to navigate the waters.
That's what I'm saying.
Over in the slave cities.
Yeah.
Without Tyrion's help.
Yeah. And for damn sure, coming over to Westeros would be a hell of a lot, because she has no idea the political landscape there, and she could be facing united, strong Westeros.
Right.
That has its shit together, that has tons of stores, that's ready for the winter, and, And
stuff after this starts to go immediately to shit with Margaery and her grandmother. What's her name?
Lady Olenna.
Lady Olenna. That rivalry just goes to 11 after this.
It's an interesting question, because I don't even think Tywin would have to kiss his ass. He would just have to not be so openly antagonistic about it.
Right.
What would it cost Tywin to promise, you know what, you did a good job as a hand. I'm going to give you a little bit more responsibility. We'll talk about some lands. And then
he does that in this scene. And then he turns around
but he could have just said, and then we'll see about Kat. He could just dangle that carrot. Just let up a little bit, and that would probably... But I just think that's... Tywin's incapable of that.
Yeah, he's a man of...
He's incapable
principles.
Of inspiring anything but, fear and jealousy amongst his children. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like real love or affection.
No.
Because he can't give it himself. Because he thinks it's a liability and a weakness. Because that's what his father... He's constantly afraid of the shadow of his father, who was known as a weak man, who was soft-hearted, and who was taken advantage of, and was almost openly rebelled by the lords of the... the Westerlands, and Tywin's not going to let that happen.
Yeah. And finally, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I don't remember season 3 very well. They don't do anything with the warlocks from here on out, right?
I don't think so. There's a couple
not
of
a
dangling...
damn thing. Why bring it back at the beginning of season 3 and then do nothing with it? I feel like that's a mistake that they made early on in this season.
I think that they laid a lot of tracks to kind of meet George later in later books that George didn't finish the books. Because, you remember there's, this mysterious woman called Quaithe that had that jeweled mask that gave all these kind of quasi-interesting prophecies. And she disappears off the map, too. But it's very clear that she'll be something in the books. And I think there's, this Warlocks and the Quaithe and stuff like that. There's a whole lot of other juicy things that the Double D's like, you know what, fuck this. We're going to streamline it and get...
But it felt like they said, fuck this, after they wrote the first episode of the season, and then decided we're not going to do anything with that go back and change it.
To me, I think things went bad between Martin and the Double D's in season 5. So that's still 2 seasons away where...
But they don't do anything in those 2 seasons with the Warlocks.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Do they?
But maybe... I'm just guessing that... I gotta say, I don't know who in the books. I'd have to look to see if there's an implication of who. Maybe some other faction sent the Death's Head Scorpion, and they just decided to go with a villain that we already knew instead of introducing some other, you know. I don't know.
It didn't feel very good knowing that they're not really a big deal coming up.
I do like how they use them here. That it kind of underlines the danger Dany's in, that she's in. She escaped Karth, and she has a couple boats, and but she's still a stranger in a strange land that doesn't understand, and she doesn't have a lot of friends, and she has a lot of enemies, and even the ones we thought maybe were vanquished last season are still a threat. But they don't. Yeah, you're right. They don't really do anything with that past that. Jeff in Chicago. Did you see Jeff last weekend?
I didn't. No.
You didn't?
Just missed him.
Ah, darn it. Yeah. One thing I wanted to get your guys' take on during the season is where this season stacks against the rest.
Oh, fuck me. You can't do this to me. I haven't seen the season yet.
This may be better suited for...
I was thinking about it. It's been like... 8 years or so, no, 5 years since I've watched season three of Game of Thrones.
It's been a minute.
Yeah.
So he goes, this maybe is better suited for the preview podcast, but due to your unique Game of Thrones preview, I thought I'd email it now. When I first watched season three of Game of Thrones, I thought it was the most exciting season of television I'd ever seen. I believe I've watched the season 3 times in full and probably watched certain episodes on top of those full season watches. Let's start with the Robb Stark storyline. One thing I noticed quickly in the second run through the years ago was that Robb Stark storyline this season is pretty boring. The progression rivals that of Dany in seasons 2, 3, and 5. Do you think this is a result of knowing what's coming in episode 9 and that no matter what he did this season, once you know the result, it will seem like low stakes? I don't believe so. I think he makes misstep after misstep that are extremely noticeable on subsequent watches, and although I was shocked and speechless after the Red Wedding, I can't help but feeling it was extremely obvious that his days were numbered. Robb goes from badass in season 2, but completely outclassed by Tywin in this season due to inexperience, connections, and complacency. Overall, I think the season was my favorite upon first watch, but falls behind seasons 1 and 6 after rewatches. It still has the start of the Jaime redemption arc, which is, in my opinion, the strongest aspect of the season. I'd like to get your input on if you still think the season is strong after analyzing it, knowing the Red Wedding is coming.
I'll let you know in 10 weeks.
Well, it's a good question, and I remember when I was first going through this, because I don't know if you guys remember, but the book fan, and I'm not saying all book fans, because I am a book fan, but they're a certain small minority that were very vocal, were extremely obnoxious this season with the whole hints about the Red Wedding and tee-hee and all the stuff. Like they couldn't stay the fuck out of, like, non-spoiler threads without their tee-hee and, oh, you just wait, and, oh. I mean, it was pretty sad, to the point that I remember Mad Brew, who was the non-spoiled co-host at the time, I was very worried that he was going to start putting two and two together, because you're right. It just, seeing this on the second time through is just Robb slipping on one banana peel after the other that lands him into the grave. But I think it's telling that you didn't get that on the first watch. So, and unfortunately, the Red Wedding was spoiled for me before I even started reading the books. That's why I decided to read the books. I was going to do this as a completely show-first podcast. I'm glad it didn't go that way, but I got the Red Wedding spoiled. I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to read all this, because what are the odds I'm not going to get spoiled doing this podcast?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
The thing is, they sort of sealed Robb's fate last season.
Right. The mistake that ultimately gave Tywin the opening to work with was him jilting
Walder Frey.
Yeah. Thank you. And as far as which season I like the best, I think season 4 might be my favorite.
Man, season 4 is fast and furious. Like, you've got the Purple Wedding,
and that's in the second episode.
I know, it's immediate. You got the Purple Wedding, you've got Hardhome is in that season at the end. Shit, there's one other, like,
the Hardhome is in season five, but you've got,
oh, it is,
you've got the trial of Tyrion, you've got Prince Oberyn, you've got the coming forward and say, I'll be your champion, then you've got the tragic turn of the Mountain and the Viper, you've got the battle of Castle Black and Watchers on the Wall,
that's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think season 4 might be my favorite season, just overall.
I remember being stunned by how much happens, like how many big events happen in season 4.
Right. There's the traveling, the one, the better traveling road shows of Game of Thrones between Arya and the Hound. Mm-hmm. I really think season 4 is strong, but I think season 3 and 4 are kind of like the high water points of Game of Thrones before you got into the stumbles of Dorne that happened in season 5, that kind of like continue to echo through season 6, and then season 7 was, I think, on balance good, but there was some weird plotting because they were trying to really desperately, you know. But like George Martin, the whole reason we haven't gotten a book yet is I don't think that fucker knows how to get Dany out of Meereen. I really don't. And the Double D's are just like, you know, we're just going to have, you know, fuck it. We're just going to have her come over and we'll invent a reason to get all these people in a room to, so they can talk, and they're going to be a betrayal. And yeah. They're just like, you know, really trying to drive a lot over a lot of broken, crappy ground to get there. But yeah, I think 3 and 4 are a toss-up of the which is my favorite. I think 3's got the bigger, like, boomf moment. And we're going to see like some masterclass acting with Jamie and Brynn in the hot tub, where Jamie talks about his role as the Kingslayer. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really great. And then, of course, the Red Wedding is the moment in Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
But like, I felt like season four had like three Red Wedding class moments, and yep, they were spread evenly throughout the season. It just was like a roller coaster ride. So I think season four is my favorite. Plus, seeing Joffrey choke to death and turn purple,
there's nothing better.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Tori W., this is one I kicked from the main email to the spoiler section. In the Harrenhal scene, I believe this is the first time we see Qyburn. Was he there the entire time Arya was there? Was this discussed more in the books? Qyburn, as a disgraced maester, found work where he could get it in the books. And in the books, he joined a troop of sellswords called the Brave Companions, who were mockingly referred to by others as the Bloody Mummers, because they're just like the dregs of society from all over the planet. Like, there's shit heels from Essos, there's shit heels from Southros, there's shit heels from Westeros. They're all wearing this flamboyant clothes, and they all look like a joke, and they're all bloody minded and ruthless. And he's kind of like their medic. He gets the bloody mummers chop off Jamie's hand, as happens in this season. And when Roose Bolton gets there, he has Qyburn heal him up, and then he sends Qyburn back with Jamie to King's Landing to kind of make sure he gets there, you know, a-okay, because he's trying to curry favor with Tywin, obviously. And that's how Qyburn makes it back to King's Landing. So it's, you know, it's comparable, but we don't get a lot of his backstory in the books that's not eventually revealed in the show as well. David R. recently did a rewatch of season 3 myself and was struck by the observation: Jon Snow is a prince raised as a bastard, Joffrey is a bastard raised as a prince. They don't do a lot with that duality, because other than season 1, they don't even really meet or interact. But it is an interesting thing to note.
And I mean, until recently, we didn't even know that.
It was one of the most popular theories for a long while.
Right, but you can't do something with something you haven't told the audience yet.
Exactly. Shaka C, when the walls fell. I just snuck a Star Trek joke in there. Quick question. Since the show has now surpassed the books, I would love an opinion on what event you feel is the most significant departure from GRRM's original intentions. I know Jim has not read...
Quick answer. I don't know.
I know Jim hasn't read the books yet, but in my opinion, the Sept explosion seemed like the most non-book event. It seems like a totally made-for-TV moment that would be very surprised if Gurm would have ever written something like that. I know it's an odd question, especially for Jim. Just curious even for his perspective on what's the most made-for-TV moment was. I mean, the Sept explosion is hard to tell because we haven't got there in the books yet. But I don't know. I think the big deviation is probably the Dorne plot. And to the extent that I guess they had to do it because Oberyn was kind of like a dangling Chad of season four. Like you introduce this badass character from Dorne, and they've got this axe to grind against the Lannisters, and then their champion gets killed, and like Dorne's just going to be like, okay, you know, they're unbowed, unbent, unbroken. So they had to have something there, but like, boy, what they had was not great. And now that we've seen the whole conclusion to it, it doesn't seem like it was worth everything we went through to get there. But it's tough because it's not. I wouldn't say it's a made for TV moment. It was just a really botched translation of a book plot that's in the middle of things, and it's probably a red herring too. Because like, I don't think the Dorne plot's going to be that significant in the books. It's just, you know, another potential rival or another potential complication to Dany on her way to the throne. So I kind of feel like that. I'm trying to think of other big changes.
Probably the biggest one in my mind is what Littlefinger says when he throws Arryn into the moon right. Well, or whatever the hell it is.
Right, instead of only cat.
The moon door, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, there's like... I do think...
People certainly made the biggest deal of it.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know why sometimes to me that seems like an unforced error. Like, why? I mean, you either trust your audience to remember that this is Kat's sister, and you've got multiple tools that you can help them do that. Like, you got fucking the previously ons, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know why you would alter dialogue in big moments. You know, it'd be like if Roose Bolton, instead of saying Lannister send their regards, said yabba dabba do. You know, it's like, why? What? Why? Why?
Yeah.
The Lannisters, your mortal enemies that had killed your father back in season one and who have been fighting away. It's like, come on, man. It doesn't flow. That's my I think the Dorne plot is the biggest. Although, I mean, if you're throwing in the Sept, I guess I would say the rescue a white or bring back a white sample to King's Landing seems pretty far-fetched. There's no fucking way that's George's endgame.
Right.
It's going to be so fascinating if he ever finishes these fucking books to see. Because, like, the Three-Headed Dragon is so strong, I'm very skeptical that the Ice Dragon shit happens exactly like that in the books.
Right.
Because they've also had this whole, like, magical horn that might be able to knock down the wall. Like, that might be... I mean, we might see a lot of big middle fingers to George by the time this series is over. If fucking George can get the books done. Mm-hmm. Lauren C. from Australia. I'm very excited for season 3 recap, and it's very timely because I was wanting to email about my favorite Game of Thrones romance story, Jaime and Brienne, as it sees its origins in season 3. I was hesitant to ask you guys to comment on the Jaime Brienne love story and that there is a view to say that Game of Thrones is above love and romance storylines. But upon reflection, so many major events in the text are deeply related to romance, sex, and love, or the lack thereof, such as Jaime throwing Bran out the window, King Robert's vengeance against Prince Rhaegar, Baelish's unrequited love, Tyrion and Shae, the Red Wedding, etc. So perhaps more of a love story than it appears on its action-packed surface. Plus, boat sex.
Right, don't forget boat sex.
Boat sex. I think the characters' love for one another is heavily shadowed in the books, the show, and the actors and directors all hinting at the romance quite explicitly, with Bronn even hitting us over the head with the less than subtle "do you think they're fucking?" chat with Pod. It's widely speculated in the various internets that Gurm views Jaime and Brienne's relationship as a take on the Beauty and the Beast trope. I think some form of love declaration or sex or marriage would round out both their character arcs nicely. However, I can also easily imagine one of them sacrificing themselves for the other and or dying in the other's arms in the wars to come. What do you guys think about the fate of them and their romance in season 8? What do you think, Jim?
Man, it's so hard to say now with Jaime being, you know, outside the boundaries of his family and mm-hmm. and his legacy. I think there's a possibility for the romance to blossom, but
yeah.
I'm not holding my breath for it.
Yeah,
I mean, there's so much other stuff that's got to happen in these 6 episodes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if even their intention was to come back to it, it gets lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. Because there's only 6 episodes, and even if they're like 90 minutes long, that's still right. A lot of shit that has to be done. You gotta beat the White Walkers.
You gotta resolve.
You gotta beat
two
Cersei.
Wars.
You gotta beat Euron. Yeah, you gotta come up with a bittersweet ending that kind of like makes people feel like the whole thing is worth it. In 6 episodes, it's a tall order.
Maybe Jaime and Brienne could be part of that bittersweet ending.
I think that the romance is hint, like in the book, like Jaime has explicitly like erotic dreams and imageries when he thinks of Brienne, like unsubconsciously and unbidden. I think that he is intrigued by this powerful woman that is completely unlike the other woman that he loved, that, you know, she's not physically beautiful. And in the books, Brienne's made out to be ugly. Now, I've always said, like, is she? Because, like, she's got full lips and high cheekbones and bright blue eyes and, like is it's kind of like when they say that Arya is called a horse face, but then she's also favorably compared to her aunt Lyanna, which is one of the most beautiful women in the world. So, like, is this people throwing sour grapes at Brienne because she's a badass and the world's not set up to handle a woman like that? Because, you know, obviously Gwendolyn Christie is very attractive. But I think that, like, you know, setting all that, like, even if she's not physically attractive, she's like the anti-Cersei. She's courageous and loyal and just and righteous and, you know, perhaps you know, also manly and kind of oafish. But, you know, Cersei's beautiful, but it's skin deep. Mm-hmm. So the problem I have with them being heavily or happily after is I think Jaime has to answer for shoving a kid out the window. I don't think that he can. I don't think that he can redeem his way out of that. I think that unfortunately Jaime's role is going to be to redeem himself through a heroic sacrifice, to turn his back finally on his family and his sister and do the right thing once again. But I don't think that you can. I just that's always been like, I love Jaime and I love his face turn in this season, but holy shit, he tried to murder a child, an 8-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. How can Martin let him off the hook for that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I were to play devil's advocate, I'd say that bad people don't always get punished for the bad things they do.
That's true.
And it's not a very satisfying thing from a, you know, storybook perspective, but it doesn't necessarily have to get punished. And if they do enough to bring him around to where the character is liked by the audience,
yeah,
then maybe the audience won't care that he doesn't get, you know, what he truly deserves.
Right.
Because, I mean, a lot of... I feel like Jaime's history gives him a lot of latitude, not enough latitude to push a child out the window.
Yeah.
But a lot of latitude because he has suffered silently for so long.
Right.
You know, being, I guess, miscast, mislabeled as this villain, you know, the Kingslayer.
Yeah.
So I, as a viewer, tend to give him a little bit more credit than a man who shoves a child out a window and I know nothing about him otherwise.
Right.
But I don't know if that's enough, but maybe by the end.
It is interesting because, as you point out, he did the right thing already and was punished for it.
Yeah.
Like, severely. Like, you know, everyone that's honorable in the land from Ned Stark on down thinks that he's the Kingslayer and he's looked down upon, but yet he's arguably the hero of King's Landing.
Right.
I don't know. I just, like, that's my creeping worry about the Brienne Jaime romance, is that just Jaime has got the answer for the sins he's committed ever since the King's Landing incident. So I don't know. We'll see. But
they have to do something in the final six episodes, right?
Right, right.
You can't
look
at everything individually and say, well, they don't have time for that.
Right. And I don't know. Like,
this is important.
How matchy matchy is this thing going to get? Because you've already got, like, I honestly think the bittersweet of Game of Thrones is going to be because the realm is going to be okay and is going to be saved, but I think our individual heroes are going to, in much the same way that, like, Lord of the Rings went down, where Frodo saved the Shire but not for himself. I think that Dany and Jon might reunite Westeros, but one of them will die. Jaime might redeem himself, but he will die. Because, like, otherwise, like, you know, what are we going to do? Is, like, because the people are like, oh, you think Tyrion will marry Sansa? Do you think, it's like, what the fuck do you think the final episode is going to be? Like, six weddings and a million funerals? Like, what? I mean, it can't, right? And, and Martin saying it's going to be bittersweet. So, like, you got, anytime you got sweet, you got to think about where the bitter is going to come from. Mm-hmm. So I think the sweet's going to come from people's individual redemption and the people being saved, but the bitter is going to come from a lot of these heroes being scarred and having to give the ultimate sacrifice. So anything else on this subject? Because that is the feedback for the week. Again, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com, forums.baldmove.com, and we will see you next week for the second episode. I am really glad to be back to the land of Game of Thrones. Next episode, The Lion and the Rose, we'll consider that next week, and I will see you there.